Good morning, everyone. I'm Susan Verhaen. I'm with Bristol-Myers Squibb at the Global Patient Advocacy Team, where I am forever, eternally grateful, able to work with cancer patients that have GI cancers, head and neck cancers, and women's cancers. Today, though, I'm here to talk to you as a moderator and hopefully be able to gather insights from you all to help our team be able to better serve patients and caregivers. But as Aki said, more importantly, encourage and support an environment for conversation. I think all of our presenters, all of our chairs said it very well, that Aki is the glue that ties us all together. And since we're sharing stories about how we met Aki, I think I'll add mine as well. I met Aki last year at ASCO. And Aki, hold me accountable if, or was it ASCO GI? I believe it was ASCO. And she was running around, as she usually is, and she was being like a support system to so many people. I had no idea that she was an advocacy leader. I thought, like, you know, maybe she was, I don't know, like, she was just so accessible and so many people were coming up to her. And at the same time, I met June. And June's my girl. So I was like, who are these women that are just kind of like laughing? Everyone is gravitating towards. And I kind of wanted to gravitate towards them too. At that time, I had just joined the organization. And for those of you who haven't had the opportunity to read the bios, I didn't really have a background in industry. I spent most of my time at the Japanese embassy. And then prior to that, I was an English teacher in Korea. So I was like totally new to the space, but I wasn't new to patient advocacy. From my family's perspective, we had been involved with advocacy groups that supported lupus and sickle cell disease. And so I knew what it felt like to benefit from an advocacy group. And I wanted to be more involved in helping advocacy groups do what they do. So that's when I decided to kind of make the transition. So I was a little nervous, but then I saw June, and June didn't know me, never met me. And the first thing she said is, "Hey, bring it in." And she gave me this big hug. And I said, "Wow, what group are you guys from?" And they told me, and we started talking, and we've been talking ever since. And I apologize if we talk too much, but I don't feel like I can get enough of the both of you. So I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be up here. So you'll see, not only is the question up, unmet needs and areas to bridge the gap, but I know how some of us might feel about industry. So as I said, this is an opportunity for me to learn as well. The teacher in me always carries a notebook. It says today's the day, which means for me, today's the day to learn something. So I hope to learn something from today and tomorrow, my time spent here. So if we could, I'd like to open up the floor on the unmet needs and areas to bridge the gap. For those of you who are patients, caregivers, providers, you know someone who knows someone that's involved with the organization or that has stomach cancer, what is an unmet need that you feel exists? Or easier way to look at it is, when you think about the time of screening, diagnosis, treatment, and survivorship, what is something that you wish you had known or was made available to you at any points during that timeline? And I'm just going to leave off with letting you know, I do call on people. So even if you don't raise your hand, I will pick you. Popcorn reading time is in full effect right now. All right. So who would like to start?
I think there's an unmet need in patient-facing communication, in communicating patient speak, not biochemical doctor speak, especially upon diagnosis. We're in such an overwhelming place, and we're being spoken to in language that is not our language. Mm-hmm. So I feel like if there could just be more efficacious, to use a healthcare word, more efficacious patient-facing communication, you know, across the board, it would really be helpful.
Would you mind sharing your name? Betsy, thank you. I'd like to speak directly to you. I think whether we're talking about learning a new language, for those when I think back to my fourth graders learning English, or we're talking about trying to communicate an already complicated subject in a way that you feel that not only did you understand it, but you contributed to the conversation, it's a very important opportunity to highlight, not just for us within industry, but for our medical providers, for our family, friends, and loved ones who are talking to us. And I thank you for sharing that. And you get the gold star for going first. Great. So who wants to follow Betsy? All right, go ahead. Please share your name.
Good morning. My name is Jamal Melisak. I'm here from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Mine actually piggybacks hers a little bit. When we all leave from our first appointments or any appointment, we kind of get this chart that shows what we're there for, maybe an explanation, adenocarcinoma of your stomach. My situation, I spoke on this a little bit yesterday. When I had left the hospital a year before my true diagnosis, I was in the hospital with the same symptoms. And if I was given the background or full chart of what was going on, I would have been able to read clear as day that there was carcinogens that needed to be looked at, and that another provider was supposed to reach out to me and find stability. Because I'm not getting that information, my signet ring cell, which is now stage 4, it sat for a full year before I was truly diagnosed with it. So to find something along those lines, to even let us know as patients that we actually have the ability to look and see everything all the way down to the communication between the doctors and nurses and all that in the background, it's hidden to us. It's almost like it's taboo for us to get that. So,
and I want to just highlight a phrase you said right there, look and see. So help me understand, when you think about what you would have wanted to know, I want to understand, how would you have wanted it communicated to you? Would you have preferred additional conversations with a care navigator? Would you have preferred some visual aid that you could have taken home? Would you have preferred some ongoing digital communications? Like, help me think about the ways to elaborate on what it was that would have helped you look and see and understand better.
That's actually very good. I think just the ability for me, I don't know about everyone else, but the ability just to know, even if it was an A or B button to push, to know that, hey, you have access to more information. This is here. If I'd have known that there is access to more information, I would have pushed that button to open up to see everything that's going on.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing.
Hi, my name is Guy Massey, and I was stage 4. I'm still stage 4, I guess, but now I'm doing a lot better, and I'm getting more active, and I'm struggling with the nutrition aspect. They always tell me you had to have the fats and protein diet. The problem is, I don't know what it is. So, you know, now I'm starting to dig into that, and I'm struggling to find out what is, you know, I'm looking at my macro, I enter my food, I look at the data, and I don't know what to do with it. So looking at YouTube and other things, I realize I need to have a certain target, which will be a gram per pound for my protein, gram per pound for my fats, and the rest is whatever I consume in terms of energy, or I have to fill it up. So I need some help to figure out that. And, you know, I'm sure everybody else will probably eventually, when you get better, you know, start to, since I eat so little food, I have to make sure I eat the right food so I can stay strong and rebuild my muscle. When I started to rebuild my body about 3 years ago, I could just barely work on my feet. And slowly, I'm getting better and better. Not doing too much. So I need to eat smarter so I can keep up with my physical activity. And that's why, you know, this is something, I know that there's no nutritionist this week, you couldn't get one, but that'll be fantastic if we get, you know, maybe, I don't know if I'm the only one thinking about that, but yeah, you know, fat and protein diet What is it?
Uh-huh. Well, let me just reinforce to you that when you think you're the only one that's thinking about something, chances are you're not. You're just probably one of the first to speak up about it. And I just want to repeat what I heard so you can let me know if I am listening correctly. It's a two-part. You wanted information around what you could eat, as well as information on the dietary aspects of it. So, like ideas and recipes, but also macros, proteins, carbs, fats, how to gain weight back, how to stay satiated, fiber, all of those good stuff, which I don't know if you all know, Americans are lacking in magnesium and fiber. So we could all do a little well to include more of that in our diet, stomach cancer patient or not. But is that what I'm hearing you say? Okay, great.
I enter my food in the apps. Okay. So now I know exactly how many grams of each category I'm eating.
Uh-huh.
I just don't know what to do with it.
Uh-huh.
You know, so currently I have too much grams in my fat and not enough gram in my protein. Mm-hmm. And okay, that's a nutrition issue. So I need to figure out what kind of food I need to change to get better. And protein is so important for us because most of us have lost so much muscle weight. We need to catch up on the muscle weight. And protein is a big part of it. And what kind of protein should we eat? Because, you know, red meat for us is you know, a little challenging.
Uh-huh. Well, let's continue this dance a little bit more. I know we have additional questions, but stay in this salsa tangle with me, if you will. Help me understand the relationship between a patient and a nutritionist. Because it sounds like a lot of the guidance you're looking for outside of maybe the creative ideas could come from nutritional support from a nutritionist. Were you exposed to one? Have you been referred to one? Is that something you can easily access, or is that also an unmet need?
Well, initially, I've talked to nutritionists and they give me the little chart, you know, a lot of antioxidants, you know, steer away from this. It was kind of a guideline, but when you start to enter your food, you know, the guideline doesn't tell you how much and what kind of food you need to eat. And that could be personal because everybody has a different kind of body, has a different kind of need. So the macros is where basically all the data comes in. And now this is where you're going to look at, okay, this is how many grams of protein, how many grams of fat I need. And now the nutritionist can help you to determine what kind of food will help you to crank up your fat or reduce your fat or crank it up your protein or reduce your protein. And the carbs, what I thought was really bad, no, I really need it now because I'm more active. So I need the carbs, but I need to eat the right carbs, you know. And it's the whole education that I don't have, I didn't have. Now I'm starting to get involved with that because I'm getting better. You know, I'm cancer-free for the last 9 months from a stage 4, which is incredible. And so now I have years, and hopefully I have years in front of me. I want to maximize it.
Thank you. I've only been fortunate enough to be in this position, maybe not the longest of times, but it is something I recurringly hear, the need for nutritional assistance and guidance and education and support. And I'm sure others would echo what you're saying. So thank you for sharing that. I know, Aki, that we had another question over here.
I just want to put my two cents into you. It's really hard to find a GI nutritionist in the United States. There's only a handful of them.
Hi, I'm Leslie Jester. I am from San Diego, and I'm a stage 4 Signet Ralph ring adenocarcinoma. I'm also a bariatric nurse practitioner, so that's actually my specialty, is when somebody decides to have a bariatric procedure and take away their stomach, then they're taught how to eat and which vitamins to take before the surgery. So when 32 years ago, when I had that procedure, I knew I needed all these vitamins. I needed calcium, I needed iron, I need multivitamins, I needed B vitamins, and specifically B12, because we live without a stomach. Then 32 years later, I had the rest of my stomach taken out with stomach cancer. Not one second was spent on how to eat after. Not one second was spent on vitamin deficiency. So I already knew what to do. I assumed they hadn't done it because I knew what to do. Come to find out, when I'm reading your input in Aki's site, there's no education out there. So I went back to the general surgeon that I had surgery with, and I said, you know, you're missing the boat. These people are suffering. And he said, well, frankly, and this is not a great surgeon. He did a great surgery on me, but he had no bedside manner.
Uh-huh.
I said, you know, you're stage four. You're not expected to survive. So we don't really spend time on that. So I'm going to give you a really great resource, guys. The bariatric surgery community is enormous. There is the ASMBS, which is the American Bariatric Surgery Community. And there's tons of information out there on what to eat, how to eat, bariatric meals. So we're now bariatric patients, guys, with no stomachs or smaller stomachs. So you can access all that information online for free. Just go Google bariatric surgery meals or vitamintation. I have a contact that I'm going to be hopefully working with Aki with that is a bariatric vitamin company who's interested in working with us, who has a whole program of vitamins we can take that are not too big, easily tolerated, and that will give us what we need. So that's my commitment for this year.
Thank you, Leslie. And I love that you ended with a commitment. We're not at New Year's yet for, you know, New Year's, you know, goals, but I'm going to hold you to that. Aki, please share her email with me later. I'm going to hold her to that. Share her email with me later. I'm going to hold her to it.
Mm-hmm. Good morning, everybody. My name's Julia. I was initially diagnosed with gastric cancer stage 2. About 3.5 years later, I was then diagnosed stage 4. It did go undetected I was misdiagnosed for over a year. So I had no medical intervention. So that's why my cancer spread quite a bit throughout my body. I think if they would have caught it when I had my initial scan, I would have probably had the option of doing HIPEC or possibly having the small amount of cancer that I had taken and removed. But because of that, as a result, I had a blockage in my rectum, which was a mass, so I could not defecate. So they gave me an emergency ileostomy, which is a bag that I currently defecate into. They told me I could not have a pull-through surgery, which would be to reconnect my colon or my small intestines so that I could, you know, live a normal life and use the restroom like a normal person does, because they said I could have a reoccurrence and my rectum could get occluded again. And also because I would have to have 7 weeks of no chemo, which I've learned from a dear friend who passed away after, I think it was 6 or 7 when she stopped her chemo, right? And she passed away, and they said that I would have to be off of chemo for probably 7 weeks, and that I know that this disease is relentless and aggressive, and it could come back within weeks, so I'm stuck with this bag. But I think my question, or the unmet need that I wanted to address, is that I was stage 2 initially, so that was at UCLA, and then I moved to Texas, and my new oncologist said, oh, you're stage 2, you're fine. So during the period that I was NED, you're fine. I requested, and I said I would pay for it out of my own pocket, that I wanted to be monitored every 6 months. Because at one point they said it would go every 3 months, every 6 months, and then yearly. And I was like, I don't want to do the yearly one, because I think that's just too damn long for this aggressive cancer. I wanted to go every 6 weeks. And they pushed it aside. And I said, why can't you just order it? I'm going to pay for it. I don't care. My husband and I have discussed it. We'll pay for it. I was told it's not protocol. Well, you know, now I'm thinking back, well, I don't give a shit about your damn protocol because now I have recurrence, stage four, that was unchecked for over a year. So where would I be now? I may not necessarily had to have had an ileostomy because I wouldn't have had that growth on my rectum. So I think the unmet need I'm seeing is that doctors become, not all doctors, because I love Dr. Wu.
Not your doctor, not you.
Everybody loves Dr. Wu. The doctor that I had, I think, was just too lackadaisical and just kind of pushed my needs aside and wanted to go based on protocol. Well, all of us here have some sort of, well, not all of us, but a lot of us here have gastric cancer, but we don't all have the same symptoms. I mean, just between Jenny, Cammie, and I, how we react to Full Fury and Full Fox has been different, vastly different. Like, I can't even imagine what they're going through. They can't imagine what I'm going through. And I, same with all you guys. I don't know how you guys are reacting to your treatments. We all have different symptoms, even though we have the same disease. So lumping us all together in one boat and saying, oh, this is protocol. Well, you know what? I'm an individual. Treat me as that individual and listen to what I'm saying. And I wasn't as forceful as I should have been. And this is the one advice I'm going to pass on. I pass it on every time I get a chance. Listen to your gut. Because that's what I didn't do. I kept saying to my doctors over and over again, are you sure this isn't cancer? I had an aggressive cancer. It could spread. Oh, you know, we looked at your lymph nodes and it was clear. You had 58 taken. I've never seen 58 taken out, you know, and they were all clear. I just don't think that you fit that pattern. Well, guess what? I'm stage four and I can't have HIPAC because it's, you know, it's in my peritoneum, it's in my small intestines, and it's in my rectum. Where would I be if the doctor would have treated me as an individual versus, you know, oh, I'm going to stick you in the cancer, gastric cancer boat. And, you know, at 3 years, more than likely, you're going to beat this. Well, I didn't. And so I think that's where I struggle with. And that's where my frustration is that if doctors could, not all doctors, some doctors could listen to us and see that, you know, we have maybe the same disease, but not necessarily the same symptoms and the same outcomes. And I think that's the biggest thing for me is just where doctors can be a little bit more compassionate. I know they see tons of patients and maybe they're getting burnout. My daughter's pre-med and I spoke with a medical school admissions representative, and they said one of the biggest things is burnout in medical school. So I can imagine once you've passed medical school and you've started treating patients and this disease where you potentially will lose your patients because, I mean, the likelihood of, you know, being in the oncology field versus being in a different field, you're probably going to lose more patients than most. Maybe you're burnt out.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know. I wish that there was, I guess, for me personally, if I would have had a different doctor, would I have had a different outcome?
Uh-huh.
At this point.
Juliet?
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing. And I know we have two in the dug pit waiting to speak, but I want to bookmark that, come back to this topic of advocating for yourself and encouraging others to do the same. Dr. Wu, I'm sorry, the table's hot. Go ahead.
Oh, man, this is a tough crowd. Julia, thank you for sharing. And I actually agree that maybe the medical profession, including myself, we have a lot to learn about stomach cancer. So if there was an unmet need, I think, you know, I go around giving CME talks about stomach cancer, its risk, rates, you know, statistics, medical background, NCCN guidelines, things that are scientific. Perhaps we need a little bit more education amongst ourselves and our medical community about stomach cancer. Most of our colleagues treat colon cancer, you know, with stomach cancer, pancreas cancer with stomach cancer. There's a handful of us who have committed almost most of our careers to stomach cancer, but there's a few and really can't really make a career out of it unless you're doing research as well. So there are realities and there are the unmet needs. So that's one unmet need. And I think the people who spoke prior brought up some unmet needs that I like to highlight. One is in order to get the stomach cancer specific nutritional guidelines, and I appreciate the bariatric stuff and it's very useful, but it's not stomach cancer specific guidelines for nutrition. I think there are a lot of efforts. We should combine those efforts, but the unmet need is that it doesn't exist. And in order to get it, we need money. Okay. A lot of these is talking about funding sources and resources and the recognition that stomach cancer affects a community of patients, and it is an health inequity. You know, people love talking about the hot seat. Well, let's talk about health inequity and the way that the stomach cancer affects our community and the lack of resources that exist. So what else is an unmet need? Well, if we had a ctDNA or a blood test or a simple biomarker that says, well, you're cured and it's not going to come back, the percentage is that you're going to have no more stage-specific survival. Like, what is, we're not using, you know, the crude stage-specific survival anymore in any cancer. So why would we do that for stomach cancer, right? We need to know a lot more about stomach cancer and understand for patient-specific risk factors for recurrence. They exist, there's nomograms, but we've moved beyond all of these things to things that are genomic, molecular, all the science that's out there. What do we need to get a ctDNA? Company that has a ctDNA be interested in stomach cancer? Well, they need to be interested in stomach cancer. If we ask for a blood test, they like lung cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, again, prostate cancer, I'm going to go on again. Well, they're very interested in studies in that areas. Maybe BMS is very interested in gastric cancer because is it, I don't want to give you the wrong drug, nivolumab. What's the drug that you guys have? Nivolumab, right? So nivolumab indicated for stomach cancer. So, well, we need to find another company, Tempest, you know, all these other companies that may be interested in getting a blood test. Simply give a blood test. Well, how do we get that blood test to be testing stomach cancer? Well, we need funding and research for stomach cancer patients. So I'm just going to put those unmet needs out there. And bottom line is this awareness, education, and if you need to do the research and the trials for stomach cancer patients, there needs to be funding and interest from pharma, from NIH. 0.16% of NIH dollars are going to stomach cancer. It's an atrocity, in my opinion, because, yeah. Well, I treat only stomach cancer patients. So, you know, less dollars for my patients means less cures, right? So more dollars mean more cures. This is like a scientific biostatistical fact for those scientists and biostatists out there.
Okay. Thank you.
So thank you for the time.
Yeah. Camille, I know you wanted to speak.
She kind of touched upon what I was going to say, but, you know, the unmet need, I think just as this disease is so varied across individuals, I think our surveillance plans have to reflect that. And I'm just appalled when I hear stage four patients tell me, I've been asking for Signatera or Guardian, and they will not give it to me because I'm stage four. And that just pisses me off. It is so useful for more than just surveillance. You can use it to check your treatment efficacy, to see if your molecules to milliliters has gone down. I think it is so useful and it's easy to use. It's just that we don't get the buy-in from the medical oncology community because I think it is newer. And then they'll say, well, you know, it hasn't been validated specifically for gastric cancer. So we are deriving data from colon cancer. But when you look at the data for colon cancer, there's like a 90-something percent correlation between a positive test and a future recurrence. How can you ignore such strong numbers? So for me, it's just having patients to have access to tests like ctDNA, or now it's, I think it's cfDNA. And the other piece I wanted to add is laparoscopies. They are very underrated. And you see these surgeries get aborted because they're spread to the peritoneum. Well, a simple diagnostic laparoscopy, exploratory laparoscopy would have prevented something like that from happening. So I think it's just access to the right surveillance and treatment efficacy tools. And I know most oncologists just follow the, or surgeons or oncologists follow the standard scans. And what happened to Julia happened to me as well. At the 3-year mark, they told me, well, you can go to yearly scans. And I told them no. And I'm so glad I did, because at the 3.5-year mark, I was diagnosed with my stage 4 recurrence. Had I pushed that out to 1 year, my disease would have gone undiagnosed. Not that it even appeared on scans anyways, because it really, I mean, my CT scans are like immaculate. According to my CT scans, I'm just cancer free, but that's not the case. And so I just wish, just as our diseases are very individualized, I feel like the monitoring, the surveillance plan, and the treatment has to be customized for the individual and how that the disease is manifesting in that particular person. So
wholeheartedly agree. And Aki, before you move on, I didn't want to forget Juliet, right? I didn't want to forget the point that you made about advocating for yourself. I think if all of you, I don't have to tell anybody in this room, I'm sure you all know how important it is to be an advocate for yourself and for the one you love, and to trust your gut feeling. And one of the, in my opinion, main benefits of being a member of a patient advocacy group is you have the reinforcement, the tools made available to you, the information made available to you to be better able to arm yourself and bring that information into your provider's office. I just heard the funniest story from Aki earlier about how she would wedge herself in the doorway when her father was receiving treatment so that the doctor couldn't leave until she asked all of her questions. And I'm not saying everybody should go act as a human barricade and not let their provider out, and then it's turning into a different type of, you could have ended up on the news. I don't know. But the point is, she was advocating for her father to the best of her ability. So I encourage you all to sit with that in whatever capacity that means to you, to always continue to advocate for yourself. I see your hand went back up.
Just to add, when I was advocating for myself, I went and talked to a surgical oncologist after I spoke with my oncologist, and he agreed with my oncologist with what he was doing. So even though I pushed and asked, I then got turned down by a second doctor, which essentially, in the first doctor's opinion, was a second opinion. So I thought, okay, well, I've got two doctors that went to medical school that are highly trained, that have experience. I don't know anything that to the level that they do, obviously. And so I acquiesced at that point and thought, okay, maybe I'm just being a little bit too pushy, but clearly I wasn't. My gut was right. And again, always listen to your gut. There's been 3 times that I hadn't listened to my gut in my lifetime, and I regret all 3 of those times that I didn't listen to myself. And the biggest one clearly is that I didn't listen to get pushed for 6-month surveillance versus the 12-month. And when they told me that my the inflammation in my colon was, it doesn't present as cancer. How do you know? You don't know that. Did you get that biopsy and get it done? Because that's really the only definitive way to tell me it doesn't present as cancer, because you did the biopsy and it says it's not cancer. And I kept saying, it's cancer, it's cancer, it's got to be cancer, it's cancer. And, you know, then they threw back, well, you had 68 lymph node dissections, so you were clear. Yeah, but that was 3 years ago. I don't know what's happened in my body since then, and neither do you. So, again, you know, I thought I was advocating for myself as best as I could, but towards the end, it just didn't pan out.
Yeah, I hear you, and trust me, my heart is with you when you say there are 3 times you didn't listen to your gut are the 3 times you regret it. And I hope your story can be a beacon to those who are questioning their gut. Because, I mean, you know, sometimes your gut speaks to you in other ways. But when you hear your gut speaking to you like that, when you feel it, you have to go for it. And there's something Dr. Wu said that I wanted to also put on my policy hat real quick to talk about. So I know you all know about lobbying and just making sure that your member of Congress, whether it be at the state or federal level, is aware of your disease state and the lack of opportunities And I think one that I can think of immediately is there's a multi-cancer disease detection test policy consideration that has been floating around for a while. I know one particular patient advocacy group in D.C. that's really pushing it. And part of those considerations would include, if I recall, additional access to biomarker testing and ctDNA. So I just wanted to bring that up to say sometimes, too, in addition to the conversations that you're having with your providers, you know who needs to also hear it. Those who are controlling the guidelines, those who the insurance companies are also following their guideline priorities. So if you're, I know Anki's working on some advocacy efforts in D.C. If you're ever up in D.C., please add that to your list of topics to talk to your Congress member about, because there is some policies floating out there on these increased screening tests. And then to one point that Camilla made, God, you are just so wonderful. I've only known you now for 2 days, but when I hear you speak and when I hear others speak of you, I can see the passion that they're talking about. And I think what's really important when I hear you speak is that you felt very strong about what you could have done and what should have been done for you. And instead of maybe just settling, all right, the cards have played out the way that they're going to play out, you continue to try to potentially alter the next deck of cards that are thrown your way. And I think that's something that speaks to Juliet's part about you need to advocate for yourself and you need to support one another. And sometimes when you hear others share their story, you might find some similarities in your own and you might find ways to move forward together. So thank you for that. I'm learning a lot. You guys, I have like 4 pages filled out. I'm learning so much. I just want to check in with Aki. Are we okay on time? Okay, so we take one more. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Cecile, and I was a caregiver for our only child, Katrina, who was diagnosed with stage 4 stomach cancer. She passed away after 20 months. And we were so fortunate. We were given all the access to consultations. We had 4 or 5 before we settled finally on City of Hope. And my daughter just really loved Lucy Lee Young. Doctor, will you remember her? She's just wonderful. And when she retired, she cried, and we even went to City of Hope for her retirement party. But anyway, what I've noted through Aki's website and support system is there has not been any kind of palliative care discussion, even at the start of the diagnosis. And there has to be a distinction between palliative care and hospice/comfort care. Katrina was able to access that only because, you know, the local hospital we had was also working in conjunction with City of Hope, which was Torrance Memorial Hospital. And right there and then they asked her palliative care and she was taken aback. She thought she was going to give up and just be on hospice. And they had to explain to her, I'm a nurse. I was a home care supervisor with Providence. So I also told her what the benefits of it is. And sure enough, the one thing that she really benefited was the mental health. She was connected with a social worker and a psychotherapist right there and then, all the way up until 2 days before she died. She was being seen by a psychotherapist in the ICU at Torrance Memorial. And she had voiced some of her concerns, which she could not tell us because she knew it was going to be very hurtful. So it was one of those where the psychologist was talking to her in a room, and after that, the parents, my husband and I, would be there to discuss what she wanted. And there was a unknown fact that Katrina does not want to inflict pain, and she thinks that not discussing it in front of us for her last wishes would be beneficial and have that. And now I go to the website, and some of the people say that they're in pain and they have not been addressed the fact that, you know, how come no one's telling us? And that's another thing that was met through this palliative care is pain control. We were connected with the pain specialist in the palliative team, and she was on that. And I'm so grateful, but a lot of patients do not know this and they're suffering. You know, I would always tell them, if your insurance will cover, I mean, I know it's a limiting factor, But I think palliative care should be part of the whole package when you are diagnosed as a cancer patient or for anything, even pain control. So that's the only thing I'd like to say is palliative at the beginning of diagnosis.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. And thank you for sharing the story of your daughter.
Listening to everybody talk, there's one thing that was brought up. You know, doctors need to listen more. And one thing that, you know, my patients and this advocacy group has taught me, I think, is we talk a lot, surgeons and doctors. We say like this and that. This is what we recommend. You should have this. And this is 5%, 20% statistics. And we were just talking this morning about listening, and we'll talk a little bit more about shared decision making during this afternoon. But I think your symptoms are really important. And why is it important? Well, it may be a gut feeling, but it may be a real symptom. And your fears are important in anxiety, and they may not be real recurrences or progression, but they should be listened to. But patients know their bodies best, right? You know your body's best, and sometimes we don't listen, and it takes a while. So, you know, the areas to bridge the gap also is, you know, teaching how to make some shared decision making or listening to each other. Sometimes you don't listen to me. Sometimes I don't listen to you, and that means outcomes are bad. And perhaps improve communication between patients and surgeons and surgical oncologists or medical oncologists is an area that we can work on, and perhaps advocacy groups like this can help. The other is, you know, the palliative component to the care. It's interesting because I put supportive care. We have an amazing supportive care team at City of Hope, as you know, but I put them on my enhanced recovery after surgery program. And these patients are curative patients. And the palliative care team calls me every time and says, Dr. Wu, do you really want a palliative supportive care consult for your surgically resected patient? I said, yes. They're like, well, really busy. And we're working on seeing, you know, the patients who are like palliative or hospice bound. So if you have a hospice bound patient or really in need, you say, well, sometimes it's good to meet them in the beginning because stomach cancer is a really long journey. And just because you're cured doesn't mean it leaves you. Like if you have a total gastrectomy, et cetera, sometimes they cancel it on their own. And sometimes, but now we have more resources. And I think if we advocate and patients, I think, the hospitals listen to you more than me. You know, how many times did I say, can we continue to do this? And they were like, no. And then the patients are like, oh, we just got three letters saying this is what we're missing. You know, and then somebody starts to listen. So keep your voices loud and constructive. And I think many of us institutions and doctors will start to listen.
I think we just need to start a Dr. Wu course and put all these doctors through like a lesson with Dr. Wu, right? I mean, because you don't find, and I tell her this often, she is a rare gem in this circle for us, because she truly does listen and she is so knowledgeable, but so accessible. And I wish we could make everybody this accessible, all the doctors, to be able to explain everything to you and make it understandable. So I think you just need to start like a lesson for a Dr. Wu lesson or something. And she's so kind, too. That's it.
Dr. Wu, did I hear that you went into retirement? Did I hear that? I thought I heard that floating around. No? Okay. Sorry. I just want to say it.
may consider it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you might need to delay that.
Yes, please.
Yes, hi, everybody. My name is David, and Dr. Wu saved my life, and you're an amazing woman and an amazing doctor. Thank you, Dr. Wu. Give it up. And, I just had a reoccurrence 3 days ago, and she opened me up and went in there and scraped some stuff up or did whatever she does in there. Yeah. And I'm, yes, you explain it a lot better than I can, so. So I'm going to be starting chemo again in the next few weeks, I think, or as fast as, I can get in. When I first started the first round of chemo, and I saw my body did start deteriorating and it was really, really difficult. And then on top of all that, the pain and frustration and all the different feelings throughout the body, I had to realize that, I'm just going to accept it. Accept this. What happens, happens. I'm going to stay focused and positive and strong. But I wish I had an occupational therapist that could help me, or I was getting massages that help my body out, relax my body and my muscles. And I really believe there's such a strong mind-body connection that when the mind is strong and the body's weak, eventually the mind will start to go, but you just have to stay strong. You just have to pull through it. And everybody here that has gone through this, it's tough. It's really tough, but we're strong as a group. We're strong as individuals and human beings, and we'll get through it. We'll get through it.
Thank you, David.
Okay, my name is Christy, and I'm a caregiver. And on the subject of advocating for yourself and telling your story and educating, I'd like to tell a little story about our son. Dr. Wu also did his TG, and he had a lot of complications afterward with scar tissue in his esophagus and being able to eat. And even sometimes the hole got so small, he was having difficulty drinking water. So he got very thin. And at the time we were trying to get him in to see Dr. Wu at the hospital, and they had no rooms at City of Hope. And he had been waiting for 3 or 4 days. She had called every day checking on him and checking for rooms and advocating for him to get a room to be seen. And I happened to be in the hairdresser's office in the hairdresser that afternoon. As you can tell, I do a lot to my hair. And it's quite often. We're very good friends. But I was telling her the struggles we were having and talking about it. She always asked how the family's doing. And I hear this other hairdresser pop her head around the corner, and she says, "Did I hear you say City of Hope?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "I have one of their directors sitting right here in my chair right now." So the next thing I know, Dr. Wu is calling me and saying, "I don't know how you did it, but we have a room for Tyler." And we rushed him down there that day, and she got to see him. So you never know who's listening.
So always tell your story, tell it with pride, compassion for other patients, and get that information out there because you never know what will come from it.
Hi, my name is Emmy. I think an unmet need is education and awareness with primary care doctors about who the high-risk populations are for stomach cancer. My husband was Korean-American and diagnosed at age 38 with stage 4. We live in Los Angeles with probably the highest population of Koreans in the country. And he went to UCLA. He went to his primary care doctor 6 months before he finally got an endoscopy with his symptoms. And he was kind of just brushed off as, you know, oh, here's some antacids, you know. And, 6 months later, he came back and was like, you know, I'm still having these symptoms. And he finally got an endoscopy and was diagnosed stage 4. And, you know, if his primary care doctor had known that he was part of this high-risk population, and he didn't even know he was part of this high-risk population, because if he had known, he said that he would have fought to get an endoscopy, you know, when he first went to the doctor, but he didn't even know. And so I guess education with even the general population of, you know, who is high risk for stomach cancer and, you know, and certainly with primary care doctors. So,
Emmy, thank you for sharing that. I personally would like to maybe later at some point hear a little bit more about how these conversations are had within certain diverse patient population communities. I know that for our families, areas of conversations around lupus and sickle cell, people just didn't talk to each other about it. We all knew somebody had passed away, but nobody knew how they passed away. It was like a secret. It was like a shame type thing. So I'm really interested in hearing and hopefully contributing to the conversations we have more on destigmatizing these conversations. And I really appreciate that you said you and your husband talked about it and your husband went to his primary care. And the question is, well, the unmet need is focused around primary care and at-risk populations. But I also think there is a potential additional unmet need in how do we have these conversations within these diverse patient population communities as well. Like, did your husband know that he was a part of a high-risk population? Do other Korean Americans in LA know that they're a part of a high-risk population community? So thank you for sharing that.
Upsets me to the nth degree that they have control over my health to deny me access. And fortunately, I have very, very, very good insurance. I don't have to go through. I didn't have to go. My primary care was nowhere involved in my journey through this cancer treatment. I was able to go specifically to the specialist without getting a referral. I know a lot of people, if they have HMOs, have to go through their primary, then go through the GI, and then maybe on to oncology at that point. And how many months are you missing? How many weeks are you missing with that intervention for your particular disease? So I think with this aggressive cancer, you got to get on it immediately. And insurance getting in the middle of it really it is upsetting to me. But I also want to talk about the palliative care. When I came home last year, so in April of 2022, I was finally admitted into the hospital. I was there for 2.5 months. And typically, they don't do chemo while you're an inpatient hospital. My case was so unique and severe that they gave me my first round of chemo there. When I went home, they connect me to palliative care. And I was like, holy crap. Palliative care equals you're going to die. So I went home. And I laid in my bed looking out on my beautiful pool that I didn't think I'd be able to spend any time in during the summer, that summer. And it was beautiful. At least I felt like, oh, I've got a great view. I'm going to die here looking at my damn pool. And palliative care isn't for people that are dying. Sometimes it is. But for me, I thought it was because my husband told me that the doctors told him, call your immediate family and friends, let them know they need to come visit her because she may not last to the end of the year. And again, I dropped down to 81 pounds and I thought I was on my deathbed. But here I am, I'm kicking, still kicking.
And again, palliative care isn't necessarily for someone who's passing away. I learned that it was just to help me manage my pain, because I had quite a bit of pain after the surgeries that I had. So, palliative care is a good thing. It can be a good thing.
I know that there's a lot of people in here, I think that, I don't know, even with a show of hands, that have the CDH1 gene mutation. And for me, I don't know if I'm just bickering, but we have these 23andMe things out here. We send them out for Christmas for people to do these genealogy things. How much is it going to take for America to get one of these test kits out to everyone to do a mouth swab and know if you have this gene mutation so that you can be, the surprises don't need to happen. Me going in from fighting a fire to my chest hurting to, oh, you have this gene mutation that I've had since I've been a newborn. And through immunizations, through COVID, through all these different things, it's mm-hmm. been staring my doctors in the face, and we just never have had a genealogy test done. If we know that there's things out there that we can save people's lives, I just don't understand. This great country, America, we should have a kit at everyone's door that can make sure.
And that was what I was sharing earlier about that multi-cancer detection test that the policy is being proposed. It's a very similar conversation. Swab, send it in, saliva, blood, something. But they're all, it seems like the conversation is skewing towards, well, we have 23andMe and all these DNA testing, find your family tree and lineage. We should also be able to test for these diseases. So please look into that. I think that sounds very much like that.
Hi, my name is Arusa. For those of you who aren't familiar with my story, I am a gastric cancer survivor. I just celebrated my 31st birthday a few days ago.
Happy birthday,
guys. It's my birthday party. I was diagnosed when I was 27, and I think one of the biggest things I struggled with was, I think like a lot of the patients mentioned, is being brushed off. And I think a lot of that came from my age. I've had stomach problems, and I've been seeing gastroenterologists since I was about 19 years old. And it was always just kind of like, oh, it's an ulcer. It's just stress related. And for me, it's something I dealt with for such a long time that I was very hyper aware of these types of symptoms. And I think as a patient, I did everything I could in terms of trying to be proactive. I literally begging my doctors for endoscopies, colonoscopies. And I feel I've met a few people my age since I've started this journey. And I think what is really tough for me is a lot of them are no longer here. And I know that I'm very lucky to be here, but I wish that there was more representation and more, I guess there was more care for young adult patients, because this cancer, a lot of us are told that it's for old, it's found in older people, but I can literally name you like 24 people that I've lost to stomach cancer under the age of 30. And that's kind of my hope for coming out and sharing my story, is just to represent my community of people. And
please tell me your name again. Arusa, do you remember me? I met you in DC last year, March. Nice to see you, and happy belated birthday. Thank you, everyone, for the opportunity to learn from you all today. And if you would just humor me and join me in singing happy birthday, I would be very, very grateful.